This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Dr. Carolyn White, professor of anthropology at the University of Nevada, Reno. And we're talking to her about the archaeology of Burning Man, the rise and fall of Black Rock City, her new book about Burning Man. Dr. White, welcome to Wade's World.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. You're going to have to start by just saying, what is Burning Man? Some of us have seen the pictures and read about some of it, and a lot of people just don't know at all. But what is Burning Man?
Well, yes, that's true. Wherever I go, I'm surprised at how many people know about Burning Man and how many people do not know about Burning Man. So basically, Burning Man is an event. It's an event that happens in northwestern Nevada in the Black Rock Desert. And the event happens in a place called Black Rock City, which is a temporary city that's made up of about 75,000 people. And the city is planned and laid out on the ground of an ancient lake bed. And 75,000 people gather there and live there for 1 week as they anticipate the culminating event, which is burning a giant 40-foot wooden man. And the city is full of spectacle. It's amazingly chaotic. There are things like art cars that roam the streets, throwing fire, huge burnable art installations, and massive theme camps that look like they came out of Blade Runner. So there's this air of people sort of doing what they want in this kind of controlled chaos in an otherworldly place.
So is this like a hippie gathering, or what kind of people, these 75,000 people, what kind of people are these?
Yeah, it is not a hippie gathering. It is made up of what are called burners. They are kind of their own thing. They come from all over the world, but the largest segment of the population comes from Silicon Valley and the San Francisco Bay Area. The average age is about 40. It's a pretty educated group of people kind of getting away from their regular jobs and living an alternate life for 1 week per year.
And sometimes more than a week, because it takes part of what you studied was all the work that it takes to both put the camp together and take it apart.
That's right. So the city itself is really only at its peak for 1 week each year. It's a temporary city. But that 1 week requires a month of preparation and then a month of taking it down and removing all traces of the city from the playa floor. So, yeah, the peak is 1 week, but yes, many people kind of are there for a few months to make sure that the city is built and taken down consistently.
I was fascinated by some of your story of the history. I guess this event goes back to San Francisco or 1986, something like that. But there also are fundamental principles that they've developed over the years and committed to writing that guide some of the study you did and I guess some of the actual participants' activity.
Yeah. So So San Francisco was the place where Burning Man was born in 1986, as you said. And in 1990, the event got a little bit too big and was shut down by the police. So that's when they decided to move it to this crazy place called the Black Rock Desert, where, as one person described, you could kind of get away with anything and sit around and blow stuff up, is what they like to say. And so the event grew and grew, and by 1996, there were starting to be some problems with about 8,000 people gathering at that time. So they needed to try to rein things in a little bit. And they designed the city, issued tickets, things like that. And in 2004, the founder, Larry Harvey, and his colleagues developed 10 principles which now govern Burning Man. And those are very important to the whole ethos of the city. A couple of notes are radical self-reliance, and that means that everyone has to come to Burning Man with everything that they need to survive for that week in the desert. So there's no food for sale. There's no water for sale. There's nothing for sale at Burning Man. And so everyone arrives with everything that they need, with the exception of ice. That's what the one thing you can actually buy at Burning Man.
And coffee, but you describe that later.
Yeah, you can buy coffee at Center Camp, but you don't want to wait in that line.
No, it sounded like it was smart. We've run a couple of coffee. It sounded like it was smart to bring your own coffee. But
absolutely.
Gifting was one of the principles, which is an interesting concept. How does that work?
Yeah. So nothing is for sale, as I said, but instead the economy is one of gifting, and that is different from barter. So you don't bring things to trade to get something else. You bring things to give away. So one of the parts of going to Burning Man is figuring out what you will give back to the community. So some people give drinks at their camp every afternoon, or others will have a pancake breakfast. Others build art that people can interact with. Others give away stickers, something like that. And it's not defined what you have to give away. It's just a freewheeling gift economy without money changing hands.
But you don't have to bring gifts for 75,000 people. You just have to have some gifts for those people you might run into, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's really up to the individual. So, you can give whatever you want, and that kind of gift giving is, I think, one of the things that makes this a pretty unique environment.
Absolutely.
Which is that there are not rules about what you have to give, but people really think about how they're going to give back, because part of the gift-giving environment means that one receives a lot of gifts, and so you want to feel like you even things out in the end.
Dr. White, I've got to ask you, as a professor at the University of Nevada at Reno, how did you get involved in this? How did you decide that this was an archaeological endeavor worth you spending a decade almost or more to study this?
Well, I was really uninterested in Burning Man when I first heard about it from my brother-in-law when I lived on the East Coast. And when I moved out west to take my job at the University of Nevada, I was working up in the Black Rock Desert on another project. And in August, our camp started to get a lot of dust kicked up, blowing over from the playa, which was nearby. And I asked my colleague from the Bureau of Land Management what was going on. And he said, oh, yeah, they're probably setting up for Burning Man. And I thought, oh, that's nearby? How strange and interesting. Do you think we could go? And so he said, well, sure, and took me along. And I had in the back of my mind that I was interested in finding a project where I could use the techniques and methods that I use to study the more distant past, so things like 18th century houses in New England or Hawaiian cowboys, to study the more recent past, so looking at an active site. And when I visited Burning Man with my colleague, I recognized immediately that this is a place where I could probably put those ideas into action, and that I could study a city that was about to disappear in the same ways that I studied other archaeological sites. And the project was born.
We're talking to Carolyn White, doctor of anthropology and a professor at the University of Nevada at Reno. Dr. White, you go through a lot in your book, The Archaeology of Burning Man, sort of a notion about archaeology of the present. And why don't you explain to our listeners what that would be?
Sure. Well, archaeologists typically look at the past. So archaeologists can be working on sites as old as, 4.5 million years old, all the way up to the 1950s. And the kind of archaeology that I've always done has looked at the recent past, so going back to the 1700s. But contemporary archaeology, or archaeology of the recent past, looks at things that are not nearly so old. And so what I do at Burning Man is a kind of active site archaeology, where I use the same techniques of mapping, photography, looking at artifacts, looking at the material world that people live in the same way that one looks at the past, but doing that for the present. And archaeologists have a pretty particular way of seeing the world. We're interested in the things that people use, the things that they manipulate, how they live in their space, how they interact with the world through the material world. And it turns out that I think we have a very particular view on how people use space in the present that hasn't been examined at all. So instead of just thinking about how people did those things in the distant past, we can look at how people do things in the present and reveal things to people that they don't quite realize they're doing.
Well, and you got a lot of cooperation on this project, it seemed, from reading your book.
Oh my gosh, yes. This has been a wonderful experience in that way. Archaeology is a fascinating field, but it's not always as fascinating as people imagine it to be. So Burning Man has been a project.
Don't tell your students to listen to this show, okay?
Yeah. Well, I like to think of archaeologists as the real myth busters. The first myth that we bust is that we are not Indiana Jones. So they learned that day one.
Although that's what that's your nickname on the playa, right?
That's true. That's the playa name that I was given was Dr. Jones. So they're familiar with the myth busting that I'm consistently doing as well.
Gotcha. And the organizers, well, I don't know if you even speak of it as organizers, but the board of Burning Man was very receptive to you studying, and they also give you sort of what's left after the cleanup, right?
That's right. Yeah, this has been one of the great ways that I've seen so much cooperation, not just from the individual people who have welcomed me into their camps at every turn, but the Burning Man organization, which is actually a pretty developed organization. It has year-round offices, and they are all responsible for building the infrastructure of this city. But after Burning Man is over and the city is dismantled, the crew of the Department of Public Works does something called playa restoration. So they scurry around the playa collecting all of the trash. And then after that's done, they have to have an inspection from the Bureau of Land Management. And they have passed the inspection every year with flying colors, and they give me what they find during that inspection every year. And it is a tiny amount of material. It can fit in a small box mailed through the post office each year. So I have the collective trash from the inspection sitting on one shelf in my lab. It's very minimal.
And at some point, if you keep this project going, the university is going to ask what you want to do with those boxes. But one of the things that's interesting is the construction. Everybody sort of has to bring their own building materials and whatever. I was fascinated, and you go into great detail, so you must have been interested as well, in one structure called the hexayurt. Could you describe that for people?
Yeah, the hexayurt is one of the amazing things that has come out of Burning Man. This is a small building that's made out of insulation panels and filament tape. It's a pretty common house form. In 2016, I say in the book, there were more than 2,500 hexayurts at Burning Man.
Amazing.
And these are things that you basically buy at a home store, taped together with 6-inch filament tape, stake down with rebar, and there you go. You've got these insulation panels. You have a place that is desert ready, and they can be used year after year. So you can basically build something that's extremely cheap and reusable.
It sounds like all you need to do is buy new tape every year, from what you described in the book.
Exactly. Yep. You just need two rolls of heavy duty tape each year once you have those panels.
And they hold shiny. One or two people, right? Or
yeah, they can, depending on how many panels you use, they can be sometimes individuals, sometimes couples, but also they can house, you know, 3, 4, 5 people if you don't mind sharing that space.
It's fascinating. Obviously, we don't live in the desert where we're broadcasting this show, but I kept wondering whether or not some of that was adaptable, because it sounded so straightforward. We have a fix-it show. I'm going to ask them to see if they want to take a crack at the hexayurt. It's a very interesting construction and obviously very popular there. Now, they call it the playa, which means beach in Spanish, because I guess it's because of the lake bed. It took me a while to figure out why playa. Was that just an affection or whatever, but it's an abandoned lake bed?
Yeah, that's right. It is. Burning Man happens on the floor of an ancient lake called Lake Lahontan, which dried up after the Holocene. And it is a vast, flat surface. In fact, the land speed record was set there some years ago. And it is a very flat surface with this incredibly fine alkali dust that makes up the soil. So that adds an element to Burning Man, this kind of dustiness. Because as people drive around or walk around, and also just through the natural nature of the soil, things get very dusty. It gets all over everything and is very difficult to get out of your tent, your clothes, your car, everything. But it is an otherworldly environment because it's so flat, it's so kind of lacking in color, that the wildness of the colors of Burning Man really stand out against this desert and make for a pretty dramatic landscape.
I was interested, in the concept of urban planning, how it was sort of based on a clock face in many ways.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really drew me to this place originally, was the way that it was carefully laid out and organized. So you have this really chaotic feeling and radical self-expression, which is another of the 10 principles. But underneath that is this amazing control and planning. So the city is shaped like a clock. The man stands at the center, and there are concentric and radial streets that extend out from the man. So you have 12, 1, 2, 3 are these the radial streets, and then you have streets A, B, C, D, E each year that are the concentric streets. So they're basically city blocks. You can tell someone where you're living. You're living at 430 and Divorce, for example, on D Street in 2011. That was one of the street names. And so everyone really has an address at Burning Man. And the streets are laid out by the Department of Public Works. Those same people that do the cleanup at the end are responsible for laying things out at the beginning. And it's a pretty elaborate survey system to lay this place out at the beginning to make sure that it's all organized by the time people arrive and build their houses there.
The other fascinating sort of innovation I found was some of how they handled wastewater. And some of the individual camps, or whatever you might call them, seemed to be right there at the cutting edge.
Absolutely. So this leave no trace policy dictates the way that camps work throughout the city. You have to bring out absolutely everything that you bring in, and that includes water. So all gray water is either transported out or you have to figure out a way to evaporate it. And there are a lot of innovations on the playa to do that as well. So ranging from the not that effective evaporation pond to these evapotrons, where you use a combination of a cylinder that rotates in the wind and some tulle fabric. It's kind of a combination between Mr. Fix-It and Project Runway to have this this system that allows the gray water to evaporate into the desert air. So if you have a shower, if you cook pasta, all of those things, you can't just dump the water on the ground. You have to figure out a way to get rid of it.
We're talking to Dr. Carolyn White of the University of Nevada at Reno about her new book, The Archaeology of Burning Man, The Rise and Fall of Black Rock City. Now, Burning Man is, like so many things, not happening this year. What will that do for this city?
Yeah, for the very first time since 1986, Burning Man will not happen. It's happened every year on the playa since 1990, and they, like so many others, have made the decision that it just isn't safe for it to happen. So they will go online in one way or another. There's a lot of conversations right now amongst the burners about what that will look like. And it remains to be seen. Maybe I'll do a project of looking at this virtual city. But I imagine that we will see Burning Man coming back next year, fingers crossed, as the world returns to normal.
You mentioned, and I read the article in the Times last year, whenever, that there's been some issues that have come to Burning Man around equity and whether or not self-reliance is really as core principle, that there's some controversy or comment or whatever you'd call it about some specialized areas where wealthier burners have left their footprint as well. How do you deal with all that?
Oh, yes. This is an interesting controversy to me because in many ways, Burning Man has always had a lot of money involved. There's always been people of different means that attend Burning Man. So whether you have a really decked out tent or not is part and parcel of Burning Man. And there's also a joke about Burning Man that the last best year was the first year I went.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think the role of social media has brought a lot of attention to Burning Man, and the role of the so-called influencers is something that the Burning Man organization and other people have looked to try to curtail. So I think that people who are just going to and having their own kind of elite experience are going to be discouraged by the Burning Man organization from doing so. At the same time, I've been attending Burning Man since 2006, and it feels very much the same to me as it did way back then. You still have this incredible feeling of community and people giving outward, and there may be people that are there enclosed in their fancy glamping tents and having their meal served, but they're excluded from the rest of the world as well. So I think this is a problem that the media enjoys, but I think for most people's experience, it's not an issue.
I mean, obviously at the threshold, people who can take a week off to go or take even longer than a week are always going to have more resources than others. But one of the things you look at, though, continually through the book is the public versus private versus other space issues, which are not only anthropological and archaeological concepts, but also a core around the 10 principles of Burning Man, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that has been so interesting to me is Burning Man seems like a very free environment. You know, people are with this concept of radical self-expression. They're allowed to do what they want and engage with the world and kind of do your own thing. Community is incredibly important at Burning Man, and it's part of the ethos that everyone embraces about Burning Man. And in fact, when you greet someone at Burning Man, you say, welcome home, that people really see the city as their real home in some ways, and the outside world as something that is something they have to deal with for the rest of the time. Within each camp, you really have a sense of the public and the private. One of the things that I've looked at is how people lay out their camps and live in those spaces. And that idea of greeting the world and being in community with people is really important. So people typically have public space within their private camps to invite people in. And one of the things that people spend a tremendous amount of time doing is really just hanging out with people in those camps. So they tend to have, you know, four times as many chairs as residents, that kind of thing. Or they'll have a space that transforms from a kind of front porch into a margarita bar, that kind of thing. So that sense of openness is very important. But as much as places are open, I think that you then see this real private behind the scenes. And that division between public and private can be quite rigid. Sort of the more open a space is, the more people need to have their own privacy as well.
Well, you also make the point that there's no perfect equity here. The founders and board have a separate space that seems to be a little nicer, a little more, I mean, they're always located in about the same area on the clock and things like that as well, right?
Absolutely. There are things that get built year after year. There, the organizers live in RVs that they bring each year. And so that there is this kind of sense of permanence that you see across the city. And that extends to sometimes individual people who bring pretty elaborate camps that they set up. But yes, there is a sense of kind of inside Burning Man, the organizers, the Department of Public Works, these people have more almost semi-permanent places that they return to year after year within the city.
It's hard to build a non-hierarchical society, but Dr. White, so what should all of us learn and take away from the Burning Man experience?
Well, I think one of the things that's amazing about Burning Man is first you kind of get caught up in the spectacle and the unusualness of Burning Man. This is a temporary city that is there for just 1 week a year. At the same time, it is every city. It has all of the components of a city that we might think about. And I think it makes us see that we are all living kind of in our own Burning Man. We're living in a temporary place. Just one that's far less temporary than Black Rock City. And the other thing is that if we look at the current world through this lens of archaeology, really looking at how people live in those spaces, we can learn a lot about ourselves and also start to understand that the world is and always has been a lot messier, noisier, and full of complexity.
And as you point out in the book, has always been temporary.
That's right, yes.
I guess that's an archaeologist's perspective when you talk about the near past and you say 1700s. Dr. White, this has been a fascinating book about the burning, the archaeology of Burning Man, the rise and fall of Black Rock City. How can people get a copy of this book or find it in their local bookstores or whatever?
Well, you can learn more about where to buy it at carolynwhite.info, and it's available any place you want to buy a book.
It's published by the University of New Mexico Press. That's Carolyn White, wagesworld.info. That's an interesting website. So,
yeah.
And if they have additional questions for you about what you've learned and your advice, they can ask at that website as well.
That's right. Or you can email me at clwhite@unr.edu.
clwhite@unr.edu. We know actually a great city, so it's if you ever get back there, good luck with it. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives. We'll be talking about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rasky from Wade's World.